So, folks, we're learning together a series called A Study of Sieges. And this is just looking at one, we'll call it, theme of ideas in Tanakh, which plays its way through. And the idea is looking at particular moments in time where there were sieges which are of significance. We looked last week at Israel and Jericho, the first conquest of the land of Israel, and that battle and the complexities of that battle. What we're going to do this week is we're going to move forward. We are actually skipping one siege, which is a fascinating note. That was the siege of Ha'ai. But we're not going to focus on that. There's a lot more to talk about. This week we're going to talk about David and Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is going to be the focus of a lot of sieges, as we will see. So there's going to be a number of different sieges, whether it be Assyrian, Babylonian, Roman. There's multiple levels of this and the way that it is focused in Jewish texts. So we're going to start off with Yerushalayim. The first time it really is Yerushalayim. So it is worthwhile to note that in Tanakh, Yerushalayim is not mentioned explicitly in the Torah. It's mentioned numerous times in the earlier parts of the Torah, but by reference. It's Shalem, it's Har HaMoriah, but we don't have Yerushalayim. The first time it's mentioned in Tanakh actually is in Perek Yud in Sefer Yehoshua. And the references we have about it is the fascinating conquest we have of Yerushalayim at the hands of the nation of Israel under the guidance of Yehoshua. So just to make sure we get a sense of what actually happens, we're told that that in Perek Yud, we're told that the king of a place called Yerushalayim, whose name is Adoni Tzedek, attacks Israel. He gets an alliance against the Israelites. He brings together five very powerful Amorite kings, and in this alliance they fight against Israel, and they are conquered miraculously. There's something unusual which happens. They lose the battle, and in their seeking refuge, God rains upon them this supernatural hail. The sun stands still. There's an unbelievable battle which ensues. And one of those kings is Adoni Tzedek, the king of Yerushalayim. Following that, we're told, and in a summation, in the 12th perek, Ve'ele malchei ha'aretz asher hikah Yehoshua b'nei Yisrael be'ever ha'yarden yoma. These are the cities, city-states, which are conquered in Israel. And it goes on to describe in Pasuk Tes, Melech Yericho echad, Melech Ha'ai asher mitzad beis el echad, Melech Yerushalayim echad, Melech Hebron echad. So Jerusalem is listed on the list of 31 kings and essentially city-states which are conquered by Yehoshua. So it seems pretty unequivocal that this is the first time that the nation of Israel has access and conquest to Jerusalem. The problem is that when you read Yehoshua, you need to read it holistically. And in a holistic perspective, it isn't so clear that Jerusalem was conquered. So if you fast forward as an example to Perek Tes Vav, in the 15th Perek, when it describes the territory of Yehuda, it describes at the very end, the tail pasuk, Samach Gimel of Perek Tes Vav is, Vesa Yevusi Yoshve Yerushalayim, Lo Yachlu B'nei Yehuda L'Risham. The people of the tribe of Judah were not able to conquer the areas of the Jebusite areas of Jerusalem. And they remained as inhabitants of Jerusalem until today. So there seems to be a little bit of a, we'll call, disagreement as to whether or not Jerusalem was conquered or fully conquered. Similarly, if you go fast forward into Sefer Shoftim, you see the same kind of problem. That is that in source 3, the very very first parak, they captured Jerusalem, they burnt it down. But just literally 13 psukim later, in the same parak in Shoftim, but Binyamin were not able to conquer the area of Yerushalayim from the Jebusites. So this already tells us that this is a complex city, right? In numerous ways, it still is today, and it's worthwhile appreciating this beforehand. Let's just reverse a little bit in history for a moment. There's something which I'm sure we all know, but if you put these two facts together, it should make us think. We know in Tanakh that in Parashas Lech Lecha, Avraham Avinu wins a war against the four kings. These are four colonizing empires, who are actually in the north, who are colonizing this area in the Middle East. Avraham Avinu fights them back. And he is greeted by, remember who comes out to meet him? Malki Tzedek Melech Shalem. Now, it should not be It should not be astounding, because in the end of the day, Malki Tzedek sounds very similar to Adoni Tzedek, who appears in Sefer Yehoshua. So Tzedek is one of the names given to Jerusalem, the place of righteousness. Right? So then it was Malki Tzedek, the king of Tzedek, and then it was Adoni Tzedek, the master of Tzedek. Right? So it's the same king, it's the same area. Just for those who say the Torah doesn't mention Yerushalayim, it's important to realize it's exactly the same place, because in Yehoshua it's called Yerushalayim. Adoni Tzedek Melech Yerushalayim, and then it's Malki Tzedek Melech Shalem. It's very clearly the same place, what's known in English as Salem. What's fascinating is that just a parsha later in Parshas Vayera, which is not too much further in the life of Avraham Avinu, really just a few decades later, Avraham Avinu is sent on a mission, and he's sent to the Eretz Hamoriah to bring his child up as a sacrifice. And what does he do? He goes up onto Har Hamoriah and he brings the sacrifice to his child. Now, the pictures we all have of the Akedah is Vayelchu Shneim Yachtov. They're ascending this mountain together, and they're in absolute, we'll call it their solitude, right? There's no one else there, which is fascinating, because didn't Malki Tzedek live there, right? If Har Hamoriah is the same as Salem, right? So then, was he walking past, you know, Malki Tzedek's house on the way in? So obviously, clearly, there are two parts, clearly, right? So the way it's understood is that there's the lower area of Jerusalem, which is called Salem. That's where Malki Tzedek lived. And then there was the higher part, the mountain, the Mount Moriah. There's a few mountains. There's Har Tzion, Har Tzofim, right? Har Zeitim, Har Moriah. There's a few mountains adjoining to each other. And when you go up to Har Moriah, that was on the higher part of Jerusalem, not in the reaches of Malki Tzedek. Let's just do a little more background. This is without doing any fancy footwork here. This is just I'm trying to understand what the Torah is saying. So let's go a little further back. Malki Tzedek is whom, according to tradition?
Shem.
Malki Tzedek is seen as Shem, the son of Noach. And so therefore, if we ever wondered where was it that there was the yeshiva of Shem ve'Ever, tradition has it that it was in Shalem, in Salem, right? Which is fascinating, because remember, that's where Yaakov Avinu stops off. There's a lot of interesting people. There's people who spend time. Rivka goes and consults Shem in the yeshiva of Shem ve'Ever, right? When she has the twins and there's the fighting inside of her, where is she going? She's going to Shalem, which means to say she's going to the lower reaches of the city of Salem, whereas the altar is in the upper reaches of the city, which is where the Akedah was. So clearly the city itself is complex. And we see over history that it sounds like there are multiple different conquests. In fact, according to some Midrashim, the Chittite, remember the Chitti who sold Avraham Avinu the cave at Hebron, they conquered the upper reaches of the city, and the lower reaches of the city, in fact, remained as a stronghold for Shem. Remember, these are two different strands of the family of Noach, right? There's the Semites, and then there's the Cham, right? So Cham is a completely different strand. They take over the Middle East. All of Canaan, those seven nations, are from Cham, different land strand of the family. The conquest of Avraham Avinu and his children of Israel is seen as a repossession of what was Semitic territory, right? Because there was still pockets of Semite control, Avraham Avinu being the return of that control. Just to, you know, people like to look at history in the 50-year chunks, you know, so it looks like we're colonizing, right? One has to appreciate the history, right? So the Semites were returning to their place. So Jerusalem itself was complicated. Now, it's fascinating to notice that where was the stronghold of the Semites of Shem in the Salem area? That was the east part of Jerusalem. Just fascinating, because you see this complexity in the city, which is always struggling to have unity between different conquerors and owners. Right? Isn't that interesting? Fascinating, right? And you know, like just a few years ago, when I had the opportunity of being at the APAC policy conference, and Nir Barakat was the speaker in the particular session I was at, he was talking about how much time and energy he put into maintaining Jerusalem as a unified city. Unified city means there are no barricades, no checkpoints, that it could be an Arab and Israeli city at the same time. The complexity of having a multicultural, multinational city. That's how it always was. It was always a complex place. It never started. It was never simple. It was multicultural. There were different cultures on different parts of Jerusalem, the upper part, the lower part. It was a complex place. We're going to go a little further. So that means to say, this is what the Mefarshim explains perhaps the difference, the stira, between what happened in the times of Yehoshua and Shoftim when describing this. You notice, by the way, in Sefer Shoftim, that there were two separate conquerors, one who had it easier and one who had it more difficult. If you look carefully in the Pesukim, the one who had it easier was Yehuda. The one who had it more difficult was Binyamin, which already says that Jerusalem was intended to be between two different tribes. So if you look at the tribal boundary of Binyamin, it moves across. It's an east-west boundary, and then it turns south to Jerusalem. So there was a certain part of Jerusalem which was controlled by Binyamin, and a certain part which was controlled by Yehuda. It seems that Binyamin had more trouble conquering his section of the city from the Jebusites than Yehuda had trouble from conquering his section. But even in the Yehuda section, by the way, we noticed there were trouble in Sefer Yehoshua. So there's multiple different parts of the city, multiple different stages of the conquest of Jerusalem, just to appreciate this over here. Who are the Jebusites? Well, it's interesting, they are one of the seven nations, technically speaking, right? We see that they were, right, so if you see the list in this, in Parshas Lech Lecha, Avraham Avinu is told that he's going to conquer the land of these seven nations. One of them is Hayavusi, right? One of them is the Jebusites. We're going to have to see that it might be a little more complex than that. It might be that the Jebusites are not the Jebusites. It might have been there vacated, and there's other folks living there, we'll see in just a second, who might be owning this part of Jerusalem. But it seems on a most basic level that they are fierce warriors, and it's very difficult to gain access. We'll get a sense of what that looks like in just a moment. Like Barbanel suggests in Source 5 as an example, Al derech hapshat hayo hamivtzar chazak mo'od v'lo yachlu l'kosha ad yemei David. So it was a very strong siege. It was a very strong fortification in this particular area in Jerusalem. They weren't able to conquer it. So this is where we start off. It's interesting if you take a look. The Malbim gives a sort of a sequence of events here as to who conquered what part when. So in Source 6 he says, they assumed when they conquered Adoni Tzedek as one of the five kings, they wanted to conquer his city, which is Yerushalayim. K'mo she'lokdu es arei chamesh ha'melachim, like they conquered Hebron as one of the other cities. V'alchu b'mitzo yodom li'lochem, they tried the best they could. V'ayo ha'lochem Yehuda. At that point, those who were trying to conquer Jerusalem was Yehuda. Ki Yerushalayim ha'isom b'chelko shel binyamin u'ritzua b'soicha ha'yul Yehuda. So it was mainly in Benjamin territory, but there was a strand which was part of Yehuda. So he says at the beginning, Yehuda tried to conquer their area. They weren't successful. Later on, after Yehoshua, they conquered their territory, but Binyamin were not able to access their part. So there's different tiers of conquest. Yeah.
The mountain seems to be saying not that they couldn't conquer them, that they couldn't defeat them. The way his language
is. Interesting.
He says, Vayeshev b'kerev Yehuda, I mean, they lived among the, they were supposed to get rid of it. They couldn't get, they conquered the area, but they couldn't get the people out.
That's what I was saying. Yes.
Also a similar contemporary
Bible. Correct. So, right. Greece goes to the Supreme Court sometimes, these issues. Right? So, this is complex. This is a very complex time. You're right. So, the complexity of living in another area which is conquered and semi-conquered. If you go back to Sefer Binyamin, in fact, if you read this week's parasha, Parshas Matos Maaseh, Hashem is very clear about, you know, clearing out the nations who live there because it's going to only create problems. So it's this becomes complicated in today's, we'll call it, colonial, anti-colonial way of looking at things and what is the Torah talking about. But nonetheless, that's what I was talking about. I just put in a map over here, which is actually, this map is found in the Da'at Mikra Atlas, which is a really a fantastic resource, where if you take a look at the map on the bottom of the second page over here, you'll see the two areas of the city. There's Mount Moriah, right? And if you look at there, there's the lowest slope where Salem is on the right. The stronghold, that's where the stronghold was. So that's down in the valley just between the Mount of Olives. We call that the Kidron Valley. So where you see that is if you walk out of the Shar HaAshpot today, out of what's called the Dung Gate, which is where the buses and the taxis come to drop you off at the Kotel. If you walk out there and you look, immediately facing you is the Har HaZeitim, which is the cemetery all the way up the mountain. And then if you look down the valley to the right, that is the area where Salem, the ancient Jerusalem, was, which still today is one of the most contentious areas. Right? Today, there are a number of people, there are a number of Israelis who live there, and there's a lot, and it's a very complex area, and we're investing a lot of money to reestablish where the Jews used to live in those areas. That's with the ancient Salem. That's the ancient Shalem area. Going backwards behind you is the Har HaMoriah area. This is really the centerpiece of it. And it's always the places which have the most heritage, which are under the most amount of contention, right? Because there's so much history here. Be it as it may, this is what we understand. So as in the description of the atlas, it's before David's conquest, the city was split into two by the Tyropian. The eastern city of city of David, known as the Citadel of David, while the higher western known was known as slope of Jebus. The book of Joshua refers to the southern slope of Jebus, that is Jerusalem. This means that at one time there was a distinction between the citadel in the east and the unwalled city on the west, which was referred to as Jerusalem. Until the time of David, both parts of Jerusalem remained a city of foreigners who were not Israelites. Okay, so this is the we'll call it the background to our siege. Okay, so it's a complex reality on the ground. There are Israelites, there are Jebusites, there may be a few others as well, and it's this living in this, we'll call it side-by-side manner, with a stalemate, not being able to fully conquer. Comes the times of David HaMelech becomes the king, where this is recorded in Sefer Shmuel Beis. The first thing he does, this is the first unilateral action that David HaMelech takes, is to conquer Jerusalem. So it's important to realize, you know, people sometimes say, what's the point? Why is it necessary to make Jerusalem the capital of Israel? It's because that was the first thing that David did. It was important to understand this. Mitch?
When you say conquer Jerusalem, do you mean kick out all the evil?
We'll see in a second. Let's look at the text and see what that looks like. So we have two versions of the text, one in Sefer Shmuel and one in Sefer Devarim.
Just on a military basis, yep. It seems a little surprising that you have a walled in area where the Yebusim are staying, and they're not able to penetrate it if it's a lower area.
Good question. Doesn't seem logical. So on the one hand, you could just say they were fierce fighters, but there must be something else. So there's something else is what we're going to try to look at right now. So we're given a very enigmatic clues in Tanakh as to what really went on. There's two very strange pieces of information that we're given, which are very hard to understand. So let's look at the text. We're going to contrast both the text in Shmuel Beis and the text in Devarim Hayamim, and then try to understand what they mean together. So the first thing we learn is, let's take a look at source 7. Ben 30 shana David b'malko, 40 shana malach. So he was 30 years when he became king, and he became a king at 40 years. I always joke. I remember I was once in the bagel store, and somebody said, "You remember Trump? But you look so young." So I said, "Yeah, well, there's a special island for rabbis until they look very old, and then they come back and they." So you know, at a certain David HaMelech became king at 30, right? So just understand all of Israel, right? So and by the way, it wasn't 30; it was 34 the first 7 years, and then at the age of 37, that's when he became king of all of Israel. Okay, so v'chevron malach al Yehuda sheva shanim v'shisha chadashim v'Yerushalayim malach shloshim shalosh shana al kol Yisrael v'Yehuda. He became a king for 33 years of all of Israel. So he approached the Jebusites, the people of Jerusalem. So they called out to him and they said, "You cannot approach until you remove the blind and the lame who are saying to you, 'David cannot come here.'" So they say there's something preventing you from entering, these blind and lame. And he conquered the stronghold of Zion, Metzuras Tzion, and which is the stronghold of David, which probably means the adjacent mountaintop. Because remember, there's Har Tzion and Har Amoriah. What's interesting, most people, we usually call Tzion Yerushalayim. It's actually the adjacent mountaintop to Har Amoriah. The old city, the Armenian court, is built on Har Tzion. Just people don't realize this because, yes, it is a little bit slopey and everything like that, but you kind of don't realize that actually they're built on mountains, and a lot of those mountains were leveled up, right? So the box of Harabias were leveled up a lot of the mountain of Har Amoriah, which is why we don't see it as a mountain, but it is a mountain. Har Tzion is slightly taller than Har Amoriah, actually. Interesting, it's the adjacent mountaintop. So David HaMelech is able to conquer this part of the heights from them. He said, "Anybody who's able to touch the pipe or the gutter and remove those who are hated by David, which are the blind and the lame," that's why there's a statement that those who are blind and lame cannot come into the house. Very strange. It's all enigmatic. What is going on over here? From there, David HaMelech built the Milah, which is a sort of a fortified area, and he conquered it. Hashem was with him all the time. So, strange, right? A lot of unknown factors here. These Ivrim and Pesachim, the tzinor, touching the tzinor, like the whole thing doesn't sound... This might give us a clue as to what was stopping him beforehand, right? There's something else here. It's not just military mat, which is stopping David Melech entering. What is that is our question. There's just a contrast there for a second to the Divrei Yamim text for a moment, and we'll come back to this. The Divrei Yamim text is on the top of the next page in source 4. Very similar. We just have one or two extra bit details. Vayelech David v'kol Yisrael Yerushalayim hi yevus v'sham yevusi yoshvei haaretz. So there we don't hear the threat about the Ivrim and the Peschim in Divrei Yamim. We just say that they're not there, saying you can't access this area. Here we have an extra detail. David HaMelech says, whoever is able to conquer Jevus or Yevus is going to be my chief of staff. That's how Yoav became David HaMelech's general, because he was the one who was able to access Jerusalem, so the first conquest. Which is, by the way, complicated, because David HaMelech already has an attrition between him and Yoav. Just to put things in perspective, Yoav has already killed Avner, who David HaMelech wanted to make peace with, who was the general of Ish-Boshes. So Yoav is already like, this is a complex relationship that's been started here. And Yoav then repaired the rest of the city. So we just did the extra detail on Divrei Yamim that the person who's able to access was Yoav. What does it mean? The person who's able to access, surely you need soldiers to access the whole city. Why is it one person who's the one? A lot of questions which come from here. We put the two pieces together and we have a complex challenge. What's going on over here? So to understand all the different pieces, it is first of all important to notice why David HaMelech made this his first unilateral action, right? Meaning David HaMelech had many things he could have done. It could have been taxation, it could have been borders, it could have been, foreign affairs. David HaMelech chose Jerusalem as being issue number one when it came to conquest. Why is that so critical to him? So he says something which is relevant to us and to our appreciation and perspective. Source 8, the Malbim says, Vayelech HaMelech Anashov, Achar She'ato, His achdush nei mamlachos Israel. You have to remember, for 7 years, Israel was in a state of division. There was the kingdom of the north, who had crowned the son of Shaul HaMelech, Ish-Boshes, for 7 years as king. He's just been assassinated by some of his troops. And then in the south, you had the tribe of Yehuda, who had coronated David. So there was automatically a division in Israel. David HaMelech sought to unify them. Shayu adato shevet Yehuda, tachas David, v'yesar shvatim v'binyamin shevet Shaul, v'roshom tachas Ish-Boshes. They wanted to have one kingdom. David HaMelech needed to create Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which would be automatically part of two separate tribes' inheritance. And it's fascinating, which two tribes? Yehuda and Binyamin. Those are the two tribes which are actually in the greatest element of contention right now. Because Binyamin was the tribe of Shaul HaMelech, Yehuda was the tribe of David HaMelech, and therefore to be able to have this convergence of unity they needed perforce to be able to conquer Jerusalem, which was this tribal border between the two tribes. So it was the statement of unity of Israel that everybody could come to Jerusalem. Still to today, Jerusalem, everything everybody says about Tel Aviv and the capital, commerce and so on. In the end of the day, Jerusalem is the place we all come to. Jerusalem is the place where all our lives converge, all the tribes, all the different parts of Judaism converge around Jerusalem. It's very important for the nation to have Jerusalem. That's why David HaMelech made this his first action. Let's come back to the question. Now, what does it mean, all these Ivrim, Pischim, Tzinor, the whole thing? So there's a lot of fascinating ideas that takes us down an archaeological, theological history. So the first suggestion, which I think is a remarkable suggestion, is that of Gersonides. That's just the fancy way of saying the Ralbag. So the Ralbag, Rav Levi ben Gershon, has the following suggestion. And he makes it, I actually like to read just the first few lines. It's actually the Rabbi Nel quoting the Ralbag in source 10. Just the first three lines to appreciate what he's saying. He is a great scientist. He is a Renaissance man. Invented equipment in astronomy, Jacob's staff, which was the precursor to the sextant, was a creation of the Ralbag. The Ralbag looks at this in a sophisticated military perspective. Here's what he says in the middle of the first line of source 10. Shebeshara ir, at the gate of the city, asut slamim bidmus ivrimu pischim. So they made these automatons, these statues, or figures that were like lame or blind people, while you are suing often mitach bulois shiyarimu ve'aniu b'koicha makloys u'motos shel barzel rabbei mishkal. They had in their hands these very large and heavy sticks, which were made of iron and wood. Hatenua chazaka b'inyan shelo yuchal adam nekarev sham im yakua som hatzlamim b'makloys. And they would move in such a way that it became impossible to get near them because of the moving of those rods. You say, well, what was moving them? And then he says, maybe he suggested that they even employed ivrim and pischim, blind and lame people, to automate them, to so to speak, to move them. But then he says, v'yusemuchem litzinor mayim ba'ofen shayu atzinor motzi mayim befiv v'yedei hagaras hamayim v'shtifosam hisna'u hatzlamim v'amaklois kasher yir bereichayim k'mo yishra'a tachbulos ele be'enav. Rabag says, what automated these figurines to move their staffs was a water system. So like you have in like a water mill, right, where the water power is actually making very large and powerful equipment move, the same thing over here is they had a system of defense with all these figurines around the city, which made it impossible for access because of a water, or we'll call it water-empowered hydraulic system, which prevented access. Fascinating. This is an amazing thing to think about, because if you think about in the last 50 years, the advancement of the military, the notion of a drone is a remarkable advance. Because here what you have is you have a one-sided battle, essentially, right? You have the risks taken by the one side minimized because all you have is a drone. And the worst that can happen is the drone can be shot down and captured. Whereas the destruction inflicted by a drone is, I mean, we don't have to look too far to see the capacity of what unmanned aircrafts can do, right? So the notion of being able to have military equipment which minimizes the casualty of the defense or the offense controlled from behind, the drones are controlled. There's you'll have a military fort in Texas where you can drive in at 9 o'clock in the morning, control a drone out in Iraq, and go home, right? So it's an unbelievable notion of what modern technology. The Ralbag says this was already there's many precursors to this, and he says I've seen this kind of thing. Says the Ralbag, that means to say they had the sophisticated military equipment which David HaMelech had never encountered. So sending his troops in would be a life threat for them, whereas for the people defending it, there was much less risk. So they found it very difficult to navigate this military equipment. So this accounts for, suggests the Ralbag, those three terms. It accounts for the Ivrim and Pischim, which could be either what the figurines looked like, or it could be even, and that Sinar, the pipe, was that which was essentially powering this entire system to defend it. And it seems like because of the logistics of accessing this part of the city, the only access was the gate, right? And the gate was heavily protected by this. So perhaps, suggests Abarbanel in his interpretation of the Ralbag, that Yoav's job was to go around in a different way to, so to speak, stop the system. Yigabat Sinar means, let's stop the system so we can have natural access to the system as well. It could even be, Abarbanel takes it one step further, that maybe even they deified the system, right? Which is not too far-fetched, right? So they so to speak, turn these into their pagan deities. After all, they were very successful for them. Fascinating perspective, fascinating observation. Yes?
They could have gone after, if they knew how these things were working, they could have gone after the source of water.
That's exactly what David HaMelech was saying. So when he says, Kol Asher Yigabet Sinar, means to say, that's exactly what David HaMelech says. We can't navigate it, from a frontal perspective. Somebody switch off the system, right? So somebody send in a virus for the, in the centrifuge room, right? Do something to stop the system, and then we can access, and that's what Yoav did, which is why David HaMelech gave him the position of chief of staff.
Right?
What was that? So there's not been any evidence we found of this, but again, we're talking a very significantly long time ago. We're talking almost 3,000 years ago. So it's a very long period back.
The source of water.
Not been any archaeological refines. However,
that's called attacking or disabling the command and control center.
There you go. So that's this is it exactly. So now let's take it one step further. So let's go to archaeologically speaking. In the 1860s, again, at this point in time, Israel was not an agricultural powerhouse. Israel was a very bare and barren country. But the British had certain interests in the Middle East at this point in time. They had a commission which was about at the time what was called Palestine. At the time, it was just, you know, it was that was the name of that area as given by the Romans. And so so the British had a Palestine excavation committee, and the one individual whose name was sent there was Sir Charles Warren. And he was doing a lot of investigation, and he noticed the following. It was fascinating. As you probably are aware of, in Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim is unbelievable. Every stone has a story to tell. So there's what's called Chizkiyahu's tunnel, which is described later on in Tanakh, where Chizkiyahu made a tunnel which led to the outer of the city to give access to the Silwan, to the spring, to inside water in cases of siege. It was all discussion whether Chazal, the rabbis of the time, thought there was the correct thing to do, not the correct thing to do, make this. It's a fascinating tunnel. You actually find the inscription of the engineers in the middle, because they actually met it on both sides. It's amazing. They started from both sides. They met in the middle. You can see the inscriptions of the builder in the middle. It's an amazing shot. Everybody goes to Jerusalem. You have to go into the
they
And they knew exactly where to meet. There was no, they didn't miss. It's an amazing thing. And this is without, before all modern technology. When Sir Charles Warren was going through Chizkiyahu's tunnel, and this was not in the days we had nice handrails and lighting and the whole thing, right? This was long before electricity. So in 1867, he was walking along, and he noticed, and this was probably to candlelight, he noticed that there was a opening in the ceiling of the tunnel, right? And in this waterway. And so they didn't know what it was, so he sent somebody up. So it was a directly vertical shaft above the Chizkiyahu's tunnel. So they sent somebody up, and they found that it led to a complex tunnel system which actually gained access to the city itself. So if you take a look, I should just put, there's a few pictures over here just to see it. So there's the Silwan channel, which is underneath. That's where is in the valley. And the Chizkiyahu's tunnel is the vertical tunnel. And Warren's shaft, which is called Warren's shaft, is definitely we'll call dramatic irony of the name. Nonetheless, so it goes upwards, straight from the tunnel, and leads to an area which you can visit today. And there's a vaulted chamber and a stepped tunnel down to a inclined tunnel which leads directly to the shaft. So I also put a picture at the bottom where you can see what it looks like, where the vertical shaft leads to. So it is interesting. What some of the arguments that are made today is that this might have been, could have been for a number of reasons. One argument is that this was a way that made it easier to access the water channels of the city, right? So it became easier to, without having to go out of the city, it made it easier access. You'd send down a bucket down to the tunnel and pull it up. Earlier on, Chizkiyahu Melech later on blocked this up. But be it as it may, it may be interesting. One suggestion that is made is maybe that's exactly what is going on over here in the description of David HaMelech. What's the tzinor? What's the tzinor? The tzinor might be the waterway. And so, yes, maybe without going to the Ralbag about the, you know, what called the modern warfare that they had at the gate of the city, it was an impenetrable fortress. So how did they penetrate the fortress? Was through the waterways. David HaMelech says, Kol Asher Yigah B'Tzinor, means to say, who can go through this, essentially the sewers? Who can go through the water channels, which are almost inaccessible at this point in time for a human, and climb up this shaft to get into the city through the way that they access their waters? And Yoav was the one who did this, which explains why it was there was one person as opposed to the whole team. So Yoav was able to enter, and maybe in the seat of command, maybe he was able to unhook the gates on the inside, or make perhaps a few directed assassinations in the city, which weakened them from the inside, and thereby giving access to the outside as well. So this is another perspective. This doesn't explain the Ivrim and Pisrim, but it does connect a very fascinating archaeological discovery with what actually is going on in these psukim. And many people attribute this notion of the tzinor referring to this shaft as well. Fascinating. And you can see it today. You can actually visit it on both sides today in a tour. The suggestion number three, and I think this is a rather shocking suggestion, in the source 11, is Josephus in Antiquities. So Flavius Josephus says, and the way he interprets the psukim in the Tanakh is the following. In source 11, he says, now the Jebusites, who were the inhabitants of Jerusalem, were by extraction Canaanites, okay, shut their gates and placed the blind and the lame, all their maimed persons upon the walls, in a way of derision of the king, and said that the very lame themselves would hinder his entrance into it. What are they doing? What's the military technique they're using? Civilian casualties. It's an unbelievable thing, essentially, what Josephus is arguing. It's so shocking. It's so shocking. Here, well, what are they doing? They're taking those who are physically compromised, and they're putting them on the ramparts, almost as a threat to David, to say, you will not be able to conquer us unless you're going to have to first kill the most compromised in society. Right? And it's unbelievable, because as much as history changes, it just stays just the same. And what is amazing to say is the following. Sometimes you'll see, and people will say, oh, you know what, in those days, civilian casualties, it was the way of war, the way of conquest, people would kill anybody, and that's how it worked, right? And, you know, things have changed. But you see that according to this perspective, maybe things didn't change so much. Maybe they realized that the weak spot of Israelites was that they did value life. Now, there are some very, we'll call it, horrific passages in Tanakh where David HaMelech does make sure to eradicate full nations. So David HaMelech is not shy when it comes to doing what's necessary. But it is interesting that they're playing upon the heartstrings of Israel. And that's today. I just remember distinctly when, at the times when there was a turnover in Gaza and there was a lot of trouble at the time, the complete opposite reactions was so profound and sad. Is that I remember that you know when Hamas were able to capture, you know, the bodies of certain soldiers, they paraded the body parts through Gaza City, the body parts, and there's Israel, who are trying to negotiate hundreds of terrorists just for body parts back. And I thought, look at the opposite of the sanctity of life. Here are people who, you know, who laud and glorify death. And here are people who are negotiating for sanctity of even the remains of life. It's so opposite. And without making big generalizations about everybody being this or everybody being that. But in the end of the day, that is the contrast one has to be keenly aware of. And that's what the Jebusites are doing. They're making David HaMelech make a very difficult decision. And it's very ambiguous as to what really happened. Did he remove them? Did he kill them? Did he access? How did he do this? Obviously, to them, the weakest in society are not seen as somebody to protect, but as somebody to utilize. They're dispensable. And it's interesting to notice. I remember I once had a conversation with Marty Schaff, and he said something that I think is so profound, is that societies will be judged on their success, not by the success of the greatest, but their treatment of the weakest. And that's such a thing that he was talking about when creating Kulanu in our community. And it's an important thing to think about. You know, every society is going to have, you know, remarkably successful people. You're going to have great entrepreneurs. You're going to have great businessmen, great advances. Every society will have their successful neighborhoods and their villas and their rivieras. And we'll be able to, if you go anywhere in the world, you'll find it. Even in the darkest of Africa, you'll have very, very successful people. That's not what makes a society successful. It's how the weakest are treated. And by the way, how they treat it is the tone of what goes up to the middle class, to the bourgeois, all the way upwards. That's exactly what matters in society. And it's important to notice that. You know, like I remember, and just to take a comment, unfortunately, you know, my family's from South Africa. And not unfortunately, but I'm very, very fortunate to have grown up there. But if you look at the rollout of vaccines, as an example, in the different countries, and we take it for granted. We were complaining in New York State. New York State was going so slowly, right? Well, you've got to look at the rest of the world for a moment. You know, Israel and America, thankfully, you know, Israel navigated, negotiated, paid a lot of prices, you know, offered statistics and to do everything necessary to get vaccinated. And Israel was really the shining example of vaccination. Well, what happened in South Africa? Well, first they had money allocated to it. The money disappeared. Right, so my government money disappeared. Then they decided, well, they're going to go for the cheaper versions. They went for AstraZeneca. Then they tested and they found it wasn't actually successful against the strain that was in the country. So then they finally got it. Then what they did is they blamed the first world countries for having taken all the Pfizer and Moderna. Because they got into line, lost, right? And then finally they started rolling it out. And then, of course, it took 2 months to get all the medical officials, to get all the medical and first responders vaccinated. 2 months, right? Do you remember, right? So you understand? What it comes down to is, how do you value your citizens? Do you care about the life of your citizens or not? That's really what it comes down to. They're having a third wave now, a terrifying third wave in South Africa. There are now ambulances outside the hospitals waiting because there's not enough beds in the hospital right now. And they're still rolling out. And they're still only up to 60. That's where they're rolling out the vaccines. And it comes down to, is the question is, does the government care about the rest of the citizens or not. Of course, the government officials and all the upper echelon will always be successful. But the question just is what about the rest of society? And this is what David HaMelech is fighting against. We'll throw out the dispensables to make it a difficult time for you to make a conquest. That's a very, very complicated situation that we have to fight. When we value life more than the enemy values the life of their citizens. Very complex reality that we have to navigate. Finally, last, and this is, I would say, a theological perspective, because we looked at now military equipment perspective, we've looked at an archaeological perspective, we've looked at we'll call it a moral perspective, but what about the theological perspective? So there's a fascinating, this takes us back all the way back to an interesting passage which goes, happens in Bereshis, Perek Chaf Aleph, on page 7, source 13. We're told the following story should be familiar to us, but perhaps you don't realize the significance of the story. We're told the following, it was at that time, Vayomer Amelech Ufichol Tzar Tzvayim al Avram, Elokim Imcha B'chol Asher Ta'aseh. Ufichol and Avimelech come along to Avram and they say, Abraham, you are a successful man. God is with you. And they said, everything Avram Avinu does is successful. So what do they want? What's the request? Vatoi Shavali Elokim Uheino, in Tishko Lili Ulinini Ulinachdi Kechezer Asher Asisa Imcha Ta'aseh Modiv Ma'aretz Asher Gartabar. I want to make a covenant, not just with me, with my children and my grandchildren, that you should share the chesed. Let's translate. Sometimes you have to what does he really want? What does he really want?
Peace.
Right. So he doesn't want David HaMelech's Avraham Avinu's success to impinge upon him and his children. He wants to his neighbor, because remember Avraham Avinu lives in Gerar, the area which is what we call today Gaza. Right. So Avraham Avinu is living in central south Israel. He doesn't want his neighbor to take back all those wells. Right, so he says, Avram Avinu was very congenial. Yeah, no problem. Now remember, who had the upper hand in this negotiation? Avram, right? Avimelech is the one coming to him with the request. He's not sending his messengers, he's coming himself. So Avram Avinu acquiesces. And then he reprimands him about the waters that were stolen. It seems that things don't change too much. So he says, "Vayom Avraham Avimelech lo yadati mi asa," and this, by the way, is also the same. I have no idea. No one informed me that they were stealing your olive trees and your borders and your water. I had no idea, right? V'gam atolio yigadatolim. You never reported it. V'gam anachilo shamati bilte ayom. I never heard of it. Afterwards, it was reported that they stole the server in Avimelech's house, and they found that, in fact, he ordered it from his own personal email. But nonetheless, it's very complicated. When he spoke in Philistine to his people, it was a different message than what you're saying when he spoke publicly in English to the rest of the international community. But nonetheless, this is what happens in this parasha. So Avraham Avinu does this, and they make this covenant, and they take. They make a covenant. He puts his seven lambs. I don't know why you putting these seven lambs here. It's going to be a covenant to show that I drag this well. And therefore, I'll kankorosh makomahi be'er sheva. Why is it called be'er sheva? Because the seven lambs Avraham Avinu used to memorialize their covenant of peace between the two of them. Fascinating. What happens immediately afterwards, after this episode? What's the immediately following story in Tanakh? Okay. The Akedah. Perek Chav Beis is the Akedah, and for all of those who are Balei Kriya on Rosh Hashanah, Perek Chav Aleph is day one of Rosh Hashanah, Perek Chav Beis is day two of Rosh Hashanah. Everybody wonders why we need the story on the Rosh Hashanah davening. After all, does this really have any significance? Right, why is this? And you say maybe it's just because you need the fifth aliyah. But the truth is there's more to it. Let's unpack this. What's the connection between the two of these things? The Rashbam, Rabbeinu Shmuel, says a very shocking statement based on a Medrash. And, why did Avraham Avinu have to undergo the Akedah? So we go through all ideas. The Nisayon, the Ramban talks about the crucible of growth for Avraham necessary to become who he was. Well, the Rashbam says a very different perspective. And this is very jarring. Rashbam says in source 14, "Vayhi acharei dvarim ha'ele, kol makom shenemar acharei dvarim ha'ele, mechubar al parasha shelamala." He says it's connected to the parasha above. I just made smaller the examples he gives. Let's go drop down three lines to the continuation. Afkan acharei dvarim shakaras Avram abris elavimelech loy leninoy ulenechtoy shel Avram Avinu v'nosan loy sheva kvasois hatzoyin v'chara apoy shel Hakadosh Baruch Hu al zois. Hashem was upset that Avram Avinu who had the upper hand in the negotiation, just said, yeah, no problem. And he made a negotiation and he made a deal with Abimelech. Sharei Eretz Plishtim Bichlal Gvul Yisrael. The area of the Philistines is the seven nations of Israel. Now, the Philistines were not one of the seven nations. The Philistines were a seafaring people coming from the area of Cyprus who tried to conquer coastal territories. They were reprised by the Egyptians, and then they conquered the area of the coastal plains in the southern regions of Israel, right? But that area belonged to Israel, right? So Hashem says, that's what I'm commanding you to conquer in the future, right? Right? So he says, and he says, you need to, you know, remove everybody there and settle in the territory. In fact, when you see Yoshua, when he's dividing the land, he includes them in the division of the land. That's why the Akedah comes next. Why? He says, Kintor of Etzira, he made his life difficult. He gives examples of Psukim in Tanakh where the word Nes or Nisayon means difficulty. Right? Kilomar. And listen to what Avram is supposed to be reading in the tea leaves. How is he supposed to understand this? Nisga Ben Nesativ Lichroes Bris Benehem Ben Benehem. You are arrogant enough to make a intergenerational covenant for the safety of your son with their children and their grandchildren. Who says you're in charge of your son? Sacrifice him. So what Hashem is saying essentially is the following. You think you're in charge of the future of your generations when I said you're going to conquer this and give this to your children, and you start making these side deals. Well, who says you even have a child to deal with? Who says you even have the security of having a child who's going to inherit the land? Wow. That's very shocking, right? As the Rashbam says. Meaning to say, this is inappropriate for Avraham Avinu to make this covenant. And the inappropriateness is actually the intergenerational nature of it mostly. Right? Meaning, Avraham Avinu, you want to make we'll call it a side-by-side, you know, living in peace kind of thing with you and Avimelech. Okay. Maybe that's your business. But when it comes to Lenini or Lenechdi, why should that have to do with, why do you think you can guarantee peace for the future? This is a complicated situation because, you know, in the last few generations, we've had, the peace with Egypt and the peace with Jordan have, you know, brought incredible stability to the Middle East as well, right? But some people feel that that's the only way to bring stability. You know, Oslo didn't go the same way exactly. So, you know, I understand it's more complicated to try to understand where it is appropriate to make alliances, right? Later on, when you read Sefer Hoshea as an example, one of the prime attacks Hoshea has in the Northern Kingdom is that they feel their security is in alliances with neighboring nations as opposed to looking upwards. Very complex. This is what the Rashbam understands is at stake over here in Akedah. Let's take it one step further. So how far does this go? So you say, okay, so is the Akedah, so Avraham Avinu had to learn that lesson. We have to learn that lesson. That's why Akedah is here. But it's true, it actually goes a little further. So take a look at Source 15. What parish is this? Very good, okay, good. Just checking. So it was when they're leaving Mitzrayim, Bnei Yisrael are going out of the land of Egypt, and they did not lead them to the area of Plishtim Ki Karovu, because it is close. So if you're walking from Egypt and you want to take a taxi and you want to get to Israel, the most easy access point through the Sinai Peninsula is Gaza, right? So that's what it is. So now, the logic in the pasuk doesn't hold together because it should be like this. Despite the fact that they're close, he didn't go that way. He went around back circuitously through the Sinai Peninsula. What is Ki Karovu? So the Targum says, despite the fact, meaning the word Ki over here means the opposite of because, it means despite the fact that it's close, he didn't take them through this area. So that's already, you know, so to speak, we'll call it a secondary interpretation. It's a subtext. The Midrash Mechilta says why? Ki Karovu, what does it mean Ki Karovu? Krovo HaShavua Shnishba Avram LaAvimelech. They were too close. The statute of limitation had to run out. In the peace deal, the peace accord was still considered extant, so he didn't have access to going through the land of Plishtim because of Avraham Avinu's peace deal with Avimelech. So here we have a direct application of this problem, right? Here, Avraham, and apparently there are still people around who are considered Lini Ulan Nechdi of that generation, Avraham Avinu, that their children doesn't have access. So here we have automatically step number one where it moves away. Let's deepen that a little further. In fact,
feel that they wouldn't go through it or they wouldn't fight?
People didn't like you going through the lands, whether or not it was for war, as we saw with other nations. Edom, Moab, Sichon, nobody likes access, so it usually turns into a skirmish. True. It seems to say that there's going to be, you're going to extend the chesed asher asis ma'adi. It means to say that there's not going to be any troubles. Having armies go through your land is always a very sensitive issue.
And this is a bunch of random.
Be it as it may, I didn't ask this.
So,
they were not end up in war. People, they weren't so happy with new people, newcomers, as was clearly seen by all the Canaanite nations as well. So now let's go take it a little further. So the Radak says, let's go back. Remember what was it that was barring access to Jerusalem? Why did it make the siege so difficult? Was the Ivrim and the Piskim, right? These lame and the blind and so on. So it could mean literal, as Josephus took it, you know, as interpretation. But maybe it's actually more figurative as well. So what does that mean? So the Radak says the following. Rabbi David Kimchi, I'm actually going to not read the whole thing. There's two versions of the Midrash that he quotes. I'm interested more actually in the second version of the Midrash, which is in source 12. It's four or five lines from the bottom by a comma towards the end of the line where it says, V'oid Omru. And they also said, he's quoting a medrash, and listen to this shocking medrash. Okay, the last one in the line is key. V'oid amru, ki shnei tzlamim elu, hayu barosh hamigdal hanikra tzinor. So they had a tower by Yavus, by Jerusalem, which on the tower was called the tzinor, like a pipe. And on the top they had two figurines. V'hayu echad iver, one of those figurines was a statue which was blind, al shem Yitzchak, as a image of Isaac, of Yitzchak, and the second one was lame, the ki al shem Yaakov, a figurine of Yaakov, uvefiem hashavua shinish ba'avram l'avi melech. And in their mouths, probably engraved upon them, was the actual text of the alliance made with Avram and Avimelech. Shenemar, im tishkar li ulenini ulenenechti. Levichach lekoshu Yisrael keshekoshu es Yerushalayim ki adayin ho'aneched Avimelech chai. There was still a anacle of Avimelech, who was still around, which meant that the terms of the condition had not run their course yet, and they weren't able to conquer it. Uvimei David kvar meis ubot lo hashvua. And it took until the times of David, so it wasn't a military issue. It was us honoring this very complex peace deal. And it's a fascinating thing. It seems to be the Jews are the only ones who really care so much about the peace deal. But nonetheless, this is what we honor our word. We honor the Shvua made. V'achacham Rabbi Avram ibn Ezra, Pirish ki'im esircha, k'moy esir, k'lamarim tosir al-milcham to. Okay, so that was another perspective. He does offer another medrash at the beginning, which says that there was also a deal made with the Chittite. It was actually, it's interesting. The Chitti were the ones who Avram Avinu bought the Maras HaMachpelah in Hebron, the Esther HaMachpelah over there. So it says when he bought the cave, then maybe there was also a deal made with any territory they wouldn't attack there. So it was a second deal Avram Avinu made, and the Chittite controlled the upper city, the Amorite controlled the lower city. It's interesting to notice then that one of the difficulties over here is that the Neched of Avimelech is a Philistine. These seem to be Yavusi, which are Canaanites, different nation, right? So the Midrash navigates this and actually says that the Yavusi were either vacated the area and were, this is now Jerusalem's controlled by the Philistines now at this point in time, as an example, or it could be Yavus is the name of the clan of Philistines, not the actual Yavusi. Just interesting to be able to put the pieces together. If you want to take one last step further just to see how far this goes, take a look at the end of that Rashbam that we're learning together. And just appreciate how far this actually goes. And he says, he quotes the Midrash Rabbah, which is fascinating because the Rashban doesn't usually go into Midrashim. He says, here we are. V'chein matzasi, this is about five lines to the bottom of the source on page 9, at the very top of the page. By the period, he says, V'chein matzasi acharei kem b'medrash shel Shmuel, v'ayu aron Hashem be'eretz plishtim shiva charashim. Remember the Philistines conquered Israel. And they destroyed the Mishkan and took captive the Aaron. How long did it remain in captivity? Well, so 7 months. It says, there's going to be 7 wars you're going to have to fight with these folks, and they're going to beat you. Davarache chayecha shebanecha hargim sheva tzadikim mibonecha v'eluhen shimshon chafni pinchas shol shloisha banav. So the Philistines will kill seven leaders of your children, and they are going to be, by the way, were they keeping their side of the deal? Just asking the question, right? But there, so those are the seven leaders because of the seven kavasos that you set up. Davarache chayecha shebanav machrim sheva mishkanois v'eluhen oil moed gilgal nov shilo givon ubeis olamim train. So that all the seven sanctuaries will be destroyed out. These weren't all Philistines. But it's the idea is sort of being extended over here to global enemies, making deals with them. And the idea that the Aaron remained for 7 months in captivity is a reflection of the seven kavasos, the seven lambs of the deal. So this is a very complex, we'll call it thorn in the side, that Avraham Avinu is seen to bear because of this. So just to reiterate, we looked at the siege of Jerusalem. We saw there's a complexity in conquering Jerusalem. We looked at the fact that they seem to have some sort of system which has prevented David HaMelech from accessing it, whether it be, as the Ralbag says, some sort of advanced military, we'll call it humanless equipment, which was preventing them access, whether it was that there was making their way through the waterways to behind the Miloy, which is, the Miloy today is an archaeological site. You can see the wall of old Jebusite area, which David HaMelech fixed again. Whether it was perhaps the civilian casualties being threatened about David, or it was this theological deal that was made, which was being held in abeyance. Up to this point, the complexity of the first siege of Jerusalem. So what seems like a few psukim in Tanakh is a very complex issue. We close our second study in sieges. Anybody know, have a guess what's next? What's the next siege? The next one is going to be the Assyrian siege in Jerusalem, many years to come, God willing, as we look at it, the unsuccessful siege of Jerusalem.